Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Mary Testa. We review The Elephant Man in Fields Where They Lay at the New Ohio Theater. We talk in the news about sideshows closing and the possibility of something rotten coming into the St. James. That plus Peter Felicia's trivia question. Please stay tuned.
What if I'm laid off from my job? What if my phone bill can't be paid? What if I somehow slip and fall and bust a hip? What if I lose my Medicaid? Stupid thoughts like these pop up now and then. Stupid thoughts like this. What if I never sleep again?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for the week of December 14th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and the broadcasts this afternoon are Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
All righty. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael. With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Mary Testa is with us. Broadway fans will know Mary from a whole litany of shows, starting with Barnum, Marilyn, The Rink, Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Chicago, On the Town, Marie Christine, 42nd Street, Something Good, Wicked, Xanadu, Guys and Dolls. And we're out of time. Sorry, Mary.
Oh, but I became a Mary Testa fan long before that, when she was doing In Trousers at Playwright Horizons, when she played Miss Goldberg. And by the way, that is one of my five Desert Island discs, In Trousers. So by all means, try to track that down and hear Mary on that, where she plays a teacher who has a few issues with a kid who wants to get very close to her. So, tremendous performance. So, I'll never forget that night where I was jumping out of my seat. So, terrific.
Ah, that's so nice. And that was a long time ago.
It sure was. Yeah.
So, Mary, thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us.
It's a pleasure.
We're so excited. So, we're here to talk about one of your newest projects, which is a Ghost Like Records release of a new CD called Have Faith. So tell us about Have Faith.
Well, Have Faith was born because Michael Starobin and I have been working together since like 1978. We love to put shows together. Nobody ever really cares. they're kind of left of center of cabaret. They're not really cabaret, but what we enjoy doing is putting songs together that then raise the meaning so that it means more thing. Oh my God, I'm sorry. You see it Sunday morning after a lot of shows. All of the songs add up to something else. They may not intentionally mean something, but then the meaning changes when we put them all together. We've been doing this. This is our fourth show. Have Faith is actually our fourth show. We did it at 54 Below, over a year ago. And then we did a one-night benefit for Transport Group. And a friend of mine, Catherine Rush, who's a playwright, came to see it and said, oh, God, I would love to hear this recorded. And we were like, yeah, we would do, but it's very expensive and, you know, we're not going to do it. And she said, I'll do it for you. And then proceeded to give us a first-class recording experience. Everything was soigné. The recording, we had 5 days up at a recording studio called the Clubhouse in Rhinebeck. We then mixed and mastered we recorded it last January, mixed and mastered over the course of almost a year. And, the finished product is this, but it all came from a show that Michael and I put together. So, we're delighted and thrilled. The album is exactly what we want it to be. The sound is exactly what we want it to be, and we're really thrilled. And it's getting really great reviews, so we're thrilled. We're just thrilled with it.
All right, so, I mean, here it is. It's religious in nature, to some degree at least, and here we are with Faith. So you're a religious person.
Well, no, I wouldn't say I'm a religious person. I would say that I have a spirituality, and none of the songs on the album are religious, but the album all adds up to questioning and just looking at the importance of faith or how you lose faith, or it just sort of resonates that way. I wouldn't say that Pink from Aerosmith is a religious song, but it kind of ends up being in the context of this, of our album, of our show. So that's what it's about. That's what it all sort of turned up. And it's funny because Have Faith, and I don't think I've said this out loud to any of the interviewers or anybody who's been asking me, but I was in a relationship with someone, and it was trying. It's no more. But every time we would have a fight or something, I would hear a voice inside me say, "Have faith, have faith." And that's the album. That's the name of the album. So that's the name of the show, actually. And so it sort of all comes from life, you know. It all comes from personal experience.
Were any of these songs commissioned, or are they all pre-existing songs?
Yes, What If, Michael John McHugh's song, was actually commissioned for our show, our show that we did called Sleepless Variations, which was actually two shows before this one. We did a show we worked on at Barrington Stage, as a matter of fact, where we just put a whole bunch of different, again, a whole bunch of different songs together, trying to give it a meaning that was something else, about how your brain works when you can't sleep and what happens. And I had asked Michael John to write a song, a What If song. As we all know, when you can't sleep, sometimes your brain starts going, oh God, what if this happens and what if that happens, and you sort of spin. And Michael John instantly came with this song, which I think is perfect. And it actually happened to work really well in this, in our other show too.
Well, speaking of Michael John Lacusa and Faith and the Transport Group, Mary was
yes, indeed,
the lead in one of the most beautiful musicals I've seen in my life.
Oh my! Thank you so much. It was such a special experience, and Michael John wrote it for me, and it was exquisite, exquisite. I'm so happy that you saw it, because not a lot of people did.
Queen of the Mist, we should say the title.
Yeah.
There is a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful recording of it. So can you talk about that show? It was the last show that I cried at. It was so well done. It was so beautiful. I don't imagine it's a quote unquote Broadway show, even in previous years. I think maybe it's a little too special and too intimate.
It's art. It's art. And art sometimes has a place in the broader scheme of things, but very often, and I know I sound really jaded and bitter, but very often nobody really cares about exquisite little pieces, except for an exquisite small group of people. Queen of the Mist is a beautiful story about an underdog. And I think that's why it touched so many people, because I think a lot of us feel like we're underdogs. And it was about a woman named Anna Edson Taylor, who was the first woman to go over, she was 60, to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel of her own design and live. She was a brilliant woman who was abrasive and annoying and had no place sort of in society, could not find a niche. And after she did this accomplishment, she was abruptly ignored and then died in poverty and blind and with no one. And it's an awfully sad story. But the truth is, she did that. She created that barrel out of her genius. And so that's why I think it touched so many people, whoever saw it, because it really is about being special but not being accepted for being special, or just being ignored, just being flat out ignored.
Yeah, and as you say, she, at the beginning of the show, she's not presented as the most likable person in the world.
Oh, she's not likable at all. I mean, she's kind of a grifter, and she's, but she's brilliant. But there's no place for that mind to settle and flourish. When I read the book, there's a book that was written by Jack Cummings came to both Michael John and I with this book, and it's written sort of in poetry about her. And I read it and cried for 3 days. I just could not get her story out. It just sunk so deeply into me. And I still cry. Like, if I talk about the show too much, I'll start crying again. There's something really visceral about it for me that is just in a special place. I don't know. It just, I always have that reaction. And I love Michael John's work. I think he's a genius. And I think he wrote a beautiful, beautiful story and a pastiche of time and music and all of that during that time, which was like the 1900s to the 1920s. I just thought it was very special and beautiful, and I'm really glad you loved it and appreciated it.
Go ahead, Michael. No, Michael.
You go ahead. I've said it.
Well, if she were annoying and abrasive, of course, you teach us in Soldiers of Christ that the Lord loves a sinner as long as he doesn't sin. What a great line that is. That's so terrific. I really enjoyed that. Also, as somebody who went to Catholic school for 12 years, mm-hmm. I certainly related to the Sister Clarissa song. There's a song about a nun. I love the lyric, Sister Clarissa is 11 feet tall, because when we were kids, those nuns really did seem that imperious and imposing.
My favorite line in that song is, somehow you know summer's over.
Oh, yeah. You know, so, I mean, that's really quite funny. So I enjoyed that one immeasurably. I thought that was great. Yeah.
Another thing is that there's so much in it, and it's not a lengthy piece, but it's so beautiful. There's so much in it. It's so complex. A lot of it is about the role of women at that time. You have a friend in the background.
The room, so that he's not, he won't bother you. Are you talking about, or are you talking about Queen of the Mist?
Yeah, the role of women, you know, and how limited they were, and there wasn't that much she could do, so, you know, to make an impact. She sees there's greatness in me, but the way she thinks to show that is to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel.
Exactly. Because, she gets the idea by going, she's a teacher, and then she does a whole bunch of jobs, and she gets booted out of everywhere she is. She even gets booted out of her own family's house. And she takes a trip to Niagara Falls and sees sort of stuff that's going on and says, I can do this. So she gets this idea that just kind of comes to her and runs with it beautifully, but obviously, you know, just is not not celebrated.
So
her idea.
I wanted to ask you about how you I think probably in the history of the world, nobody has put a song by Bjork and Richard Rodgers together. So tell us how,
like
how that
10 years old. That piece is like 10 years old. We did that about 10 years ago. We started working on that. It was my idea actually. And Michael, of course, executed it.
Well, let's tell everybody what it is. So it's Unraveled by Bjork and If I Loved You by Richard Rodgers.
Yeah.
So tell us about
it. It occurred to me that the cording is, almost identical. And so I put them together because I was listening to Bjork. I'm a fan of Bjork, and I was listening to her, and I was like, oh my goodness, I hear If I Love You in this. And so I put it together. We put it together, and it works. I mean, it works. I think it works thematically, and it also works musically.
So that's... you know, you're straddling the line. I mean, you have you start off with Michael John and Shakespeare and Starobin and Jill Soble and Steven Tyler from Aerosmith and Prince, mm-hmm. Prince and Wendy and Lisa, and then you go to Bill Finn and Michael Smith. So you're going in and out of the musical theater genre into Annie Lennox, mm-hmm. And Brian Wilson. So it's How did you put all these different genres of music together and make such a wonderful through line?
Well, that's the way Michael and I like to work. We don't like to just stay in the land of musical theater, uh-huh. and we don't like to stay in the land of American songbook. Our tastes are eclectic, and because they are, we can find through lines. So that's what we do. We put together shows that, with all kinds of disparate music, as I said in the beginning, that then brings it to a whole other meaning. And we're interested in that. We're interested in just doing the eclectic and finding the pieces that interest us musically. So they could be from anywhere, you know. We're starting to work on another show, and we already have some mashup ideas and some interesting ideas. So I just, you know, when I started my career, I never intended to be in musical theater. I never studied musical theater. I had no background for musical theater. I just wanted to be an actor, and I wanted to do music, but I was going to do them separately. And someone heard me sing, and then all they wanted to see me for was musical theater. So my head is not necessarily in, you know, straight classic musical theater, which is why I like working on new stuff, because that's the kind of stuff that interests me. So I am a little bit of an odd duck, sort of, and all these years later, you know, known for musical theater, but it's not really what I wanted to do. Funny.
Well, that is funny. You do have another show song there, which is Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries, which starts the album from the musical Good News. When I was hearing the line, keep repeating, it's the berries, I thought, I'm going to keep repeating this track on the album. I really like this track. I think it's really it's so interesting that in one of the songs there's the line, if there is a heaven, we'll find it. If there is no heaven, we'll find a heaven of our own right here. And I think you've certainly achieved that with that album.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad. Michael and I both think it's beautiful, and we're really always touched when somebody else does too. So thank you very much. Appreciate that. You put it out there. You create something, and you don't know how it's going to be received. And I know there's tons of albums out there with people, you know, doing the American Songbook and doing their versions of a song that's been sung a million different ways. And while that's all great and I appreciate that, I kind of don't want to do that. You know, I mean, Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries has been done a million times, I'm sure, but we try and do it differently in a context that's different. So I don't know, you know, I'm funny that way.
Mary, I hope that you don't mind, but I wanted to remind our listeners that this CD has been released a couple days ago, and it fits perfectly into a stocking.
Uh-huh. Nice. Yes, it was released December 2nd on Shikaboom Ghost Light. They're very sweet to take us on. And yes, it does fit into a stocking. And, you know, I think you can dance to it.
You can. It fits directly into a stocking, or even in an iTunes gift card that you could buy that could fit into a stocking as well.
Even better.
Purchase that all over the place.
But if you actually get the album, I think the artwork is really good on it.
Yes. And we're missing a lot in digital downloads when we miss the packaging and the liner notes and all the other great stuff. But more importantly, if you buy this CD, you can bring it down to the Laurie Beachman Theater on January 4th and 5th or 11th and 12th. And
yes. Also, we are going to do a signing and a bit of some of the album at Barnes & Noble on the 6th of January. The 86th Street Barnes & Noble in Lexington, we are going to do about four or five things from the album, and we're going to sign albums. Yay!
That's great. So we'll have to put links to that in the show notes. But Mary, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning to tell us about your recent project.
I'm so thrilled, and I'm delighted that all three of you are on the phone. And I'm a fan of all three of yours, so thank you for including me. I really appreciate it, and I hope you have wonderful holidays.
Thanks, you too.
All right.
And we'll speak with you soon, okay?
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
If I loved you time and again, I would try to say all I want you to know. If I loved you
So, recently opening on Broadway is The Elephant Man, starring some guy named Bradley Cooper or something like that. Michael, Peter, and I got a chance to see it this week.
James, why don't you start? Tell us what you thought.
Well, I have to say that I was very, very impressed with not only Bradley Cooper, but also the play and the direction of it. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, this is the thing, is that I don't think I'd ever seen it before. And I thought that I had seen it, and then I was like, maybe I'd seen the movie. Mm-hmm. And when's the last time it was around that I might have seen it?
10 years ago, 15, something like that. It did get a revival.
They crewed up.
Yeah.
Oh, I did see that.
And
yeah,
it didn't last very long at all.
No, I did see that that Billy Crudup production. And I couldn't remember, and I kept on thinking to check it out and go look it up. But I thought that the one of the things that my wife said that I felt immediately was that it flew very fast for me. I could, you know, it was two hours and some, and we had a very long delay starting the show. So it started 8:15 or so. But I felt like, wow, it's the first act is over. Wow, the second act is over. It was very fast for me, and I thought that it was very well done.
Yeah, you know, I felt it went very quickly, too, to the point at which I even wondered if they had cut something out of it.
They did.
Uh-huh. So,
what did they cut, Michael?
Well, I almost directed the play once, so I one time knew it fairly well. I haven't reread it, but I know, for example, that scene with the pinheads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was considerably longer. Well, I mean, not much longer, but he actually had dialogue with them in the original version, whereas now he just kind of sees them behind a screen and just kind of makes noises and they kind of say hello a few times.
Maybe they were afraid by Sideshow's failure.
I was going to bring that up, actually. Yeah. But and then the other places I'm not sure, but I do know that there were some cuts. Nothing tremendous, but that just helped give you the impression of how brief it was and how it fleetly moved along.
I liked it very much because I love direction, and Scott Ellis did it here, where people are close to the lip of the stage. And there was a lot of that here. It was played very much up front. You can see, you can hear. It makes a difference. And I'm always very disappointed when directors insist on playing scenes way, way back. I think it was one of the problems, by the way, why Rocky failed, because of the technology, the scenes in the apartment had to be way back, way upstage. And that's alienating. So I think one of the reasons this one works so well is because of that. But of course, Bradley Cooper is quite wonderful in contorting himself and coming out with that very strange voice for all the time that he's up there. I didn't hear good things about Patricia Clarkson, but I thought she was very good.
I thought she was great. Yeah.
Yeah, you did too? Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, Michael?
Well, were neither of you put out by her complete lack of a British accent?
No.
No.
No, I understand your point, you know.
Well, I mean,
I mean, obviously, you know,
because everyone else to my ears had a perfect British accent. And also on top of that, she is specifically supposed to be a leading light of the British stage.
Yeah.
So I really was very put out, especially in the beginning. I will say that her performance was so wonderful that ultimately it mattered less. But I do wonder if that's because she can't.
Right. Yeah, it might very well be.
Yeah, or just some decision to that effect. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we'll never know.
Yeah. Unless she tells us. Nice character actors in the show, too. Henry Stram, who you may not know, but I'm talking about our listeners because, I mean, he's not a star by any means. And Catherine Meisley, they're wonderful actors. And here they are in small roles, but they really made them count.
And Anthony Heald in two roles and so unrecognizable from one to the other that when someone else, someone next to me said it was the same person and I hadn't checked the program yet, I said, oh, no, I don't think so. because not only he plays Ross, who is this fellow who sort of latches on to the Elephant Man and exhibits him in sideshows, and then later on he plays Bishop. Well, actually he alternates playing Bishop Howe. And one of the reasons that I really did not think it was the same person is that as Ross, he had a beard, you know, he had but like not even a full beard, which I would think, you know, you could be almost easier to slap on, but just like whiskers. Mm-hmm. And then he was clean shaven for Bishop Howe. So I was very impressed with that. And I almost wonder why they bothered rather than have someone else, you know, have two actors, but he did them both brilliantly. So I have not seen him on stage in quite some time. So
it has been a while. Yeah, it really has. Catherine Meisley, by the way, who I very much admire, has that very important scene as the nurse who comes in and Treves, the doctor, says to her, look, you know, this guy is really, really odd looking. And please, I'm a nurse. I've seen everything. You know, don't worry about it. Stop. Will you please? I mean, I'm telling you, you know, by the way, it's more lofty language than I'm giving you here. But nevertheless, when she goes in, the moment she sees him, it's over. I mean, she is repulsed beyond belief. And that's when we really, really know how bad this guy is. If somebody who's a professional in this field can't take him, that's really something.
It's selling quite well based upon,
isn't it?
Yes. Based upon you know, the throngs of fans of Bradley Cooper. But it's one of those things where I wonder. I think it's a great production. If Bradley Cooper was not in it, you know, this is an overall question about Broadway. Would it be selling so well?
By no means. But what we have to do is look at the glass in a different way. And that is the fact that because people are coming to see Bradley Cooper, they come away saying, wow, this thing called the Broadway play is really pretty good. I got to go to more of these. And I think this one will help that. So I don't think it'll be the last time the people who go simply to see Bradley Cooper will indeed go to see a play, because this one packs a wallop.
I thought he was lovely, just really wonderful in the role. I would say he was the best that I've seen. I also felt it was a performance without ego, which is really quite
That's
a
right.
statement.
That's
but
right.
I mean, just the way it was presented, the fact that there was only an ensemble bow at the end, no solo bow.
Yeah, wasn't that something?
Right?
I was surprised at that.
The fact that even that his face is not in the ads. You know, and, I mean, not on the marquee, not on the Playbill cover.
And as we all know, there are standing ovations and there are standing ovations. And do you notice those people leapt up at the end as if they were prodded by electronic cattle prods? I mean, they really jumped up very, very quickly. It was one of the shortest times between an end of a play and a standing ovation. So when they're that quick, that's when people really mean them. This wasn't a case of, well, let me stand because I want to see the curtain call, you know, because people are in front of me. This was really electric, and I thought that was tremendously telling.
Now, James, as someone who didn't know it as well, I have a question for you.
Yes.
It struck me again in seeing this play. It's amazing how similar the role of Treves in this play and the role of the doctor in Equus, Dysart, are.
Sure.
And they both came out within like 4 years of each other, these plays, in the 70s. And it's kind of, I guess, something that was in the zeitgeist at the time, a physician, heal thyself kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
they
almost have very similar issues. It's supposed to be that they're out of touch with, they're all about, you know, science, but they're out of touch with emotions and they wonder what their purpose is, and they look at their patients, who, although their patients have extreme problems, seem to be in ways much better human beings than they are because they feel blah blah blah. So and the Elephant Man and I guess Equus to a certain extent have both been criticized by some people for focusing too much on that. There is that one scene towards the end of The Elephant Man where Treves has sort of a crisis, an emotional crisis. And I know a lot of people, including myself, feel that maybe the focus is not you know, it's not where we want the focus to be at that point. Did you get that at all?
Well, what I want to add is, of course I got that, but what I also want to add is we also have another play on Broadway doing much the same thing, too. The Curious Incident of the Dog has a very similar situation where we have somebody who's in charge and does a lot of learning from the person he's in charge of, who is an atypical human being. So there's a lot of that going around, and I guess that's
maybe
that's
it's a British thing because they're
maybe
all
it is people, right. Yeah,
all three are British plays.
Yeah, isn't there something though that the Elephant Man when it came out originally, we all assumed that we would see a lot more from Bernard Pomerantz, the writer. We certainly expected more from Philip Anglim, who played the Elephant Man in that production and did astonishingly well. A lot of people thought he was going to win the Tony. He didn't. Tom Conti won that year for Whose Life Is It Anyway? But we really thought we'd hear a lot more from those two people, and it didn't quite happen that way. So these turned out to be one-hit wonders, but at least Pomerantz has seen his play done on Broadway twice more. So this is the second revival, and that's pretty impressive for a play of this scope.
By the way, I'm just from memory, but wasn't the original production televised?
Boy, that sounds familiar to me.
Doesn't
I can't
it?
Say for sure.
Yeah,
but that sounds familiar to me. It certainly doesn't live in my house, but
I haven't done the research, but I hope maybe that's available somehow. Yeah, so check it out, folks.
There's also the strangeness of the two movies. You know, that they weren't exactly the same. The two movies were made in the same subject, one based on the play and one not, but based on these situations. So
two movies.
There was one movie that was really based on the play and one that wasn't. I've seen neither one, so I'm not equipped to say anything about it. But there definitely were two Elephant Man movies made.
So IMDb has the Elephant Man that was filmed on stage in London in 1982.
So that's what Michael's referring to.
The television, let's see, Kevin Conway.
Yeah, that's the
Philip
Broadway cast.
Anglin.
Yeah,
Glenn Close.
Glenn
Close is Princess Alexandra. Wonder how her English accent was.
Princess Alexandra. Oh, so she wasn't Fanny Kendall.
She wasn't Kendall. No, Penny Fuller was Kendall.
That's right.
Richard Clarke was.
So Michael,
Christopher Hewitt was in it.
You saw it then, Michael? Or
yes, I did. I had Penny Fuller in the back. I was like, did I see her as a replacement? But no, actually, I saw Patricia Elliott.
Yeah,
on Broadway.
It was very good too.
I think maybe that's the other one you're referring to, Peter, because there was the one with John. Now I always mess it up. John Hurt.
Mel Brooks was involved with one, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, he produced it.
Okay, is that what it was?
And David Lynch directed it. That was the big movie. It was in black and white. But it was John Hurt.
Yeah, I do recall this. We're all doing the best we can here. But anyway, it's so funny, you know, because you don't expect Mel Brooks to be involved with a project such as this. But I'm not.
Wasn't Anne Bancroft Mrs. Kendall?
Yes, right.
1980, Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt.
And Hurt, right, yeah. And John Gielgud, even, and Wendy Hiller. Yeah, boy, this is worth investigating. So that's what I'm thinking of. One TV presentation and this. Okay, so that explains that.
Yes, and Anne Bancroft was Mrs. Kendall.
Okay, and checking IBDB. Yes, okay, so this one that we're talking about now with John Hurt and Anne Bancroft was based on the book.
Right.
That Treves wrote and one that Ashley Montague wrote. Two books provided that. So the other one that was done for TV in Britain is the one that was really based on the play. Okay.
Okay.
So that's the difference.
And I am assuming, again, I was supposed to direct it once and I did all the research at the time, but that was 1980. So
things were hard to get then.
Mrs. Kendall, I believe, was a historic figure.
Yeah. Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. So my question about the Bradley Cooper, if he were in it or not you're not in it. In fact, would this be so successful? Leads me to another article. I think it was in Variety or Deadline or something like that, that was talking about how the plays with huge stars in them, the Hugh Jackmans and the Bradley Coopers, are doing really well, whereas Matilda was down $500,000 last week. And of course, we talk about Sideshow not doing well. And in fact, something right in the middle there, Honeymoon in Vegas, has a star in it with Tony Danza that is not quite doing well. You know, what do we think that this is an example of where Broadway is heading, that you're going really have to have a star cast in these things to keep a show open? Or
there used to be a lot of stars that used to come Broadway, but what the difference was that they used to sign for a year or two, or even have a run of the play contract. That was known to happen, and those were the good old days. See, in the old days, you could pay back a musical within a year. So if Rosalind Russell decides to do Wonderful Town for a year, well, that's enough time to make money. And if Carol Channing comes in and she doesn't do business, which is what happened, okay, you close it, but still everybody's made a little money. But now, of course, it takes longer than a year to pay back on a musical, so it doesn't pay to have a star. Because when you have a star in a musical, well, the problem is the star is going to leave, and then people aren't going to want to see it nearly as much unless you can get another star equally as big. And that's why maybe that replacement Tony idea was not such a bad idea at all, because maybe that would lure people saying, okay, let me get my quarter of my EGOT here by appearing, and in the fourth or fifth year of The Lion King or Wicked or what have you. But I'm afraid that's the real problem, that today's stars only want to come for a limited amount of time. We do get bigger stars than we were getting in the past 25, 30 years, because they do deal with the limited engagement. And it's really interesting that William Goldman in The Season, the book he wrote in 1969, was one who said the limited engagement is a promising thing. And it didn't seem to be something anybody was interested in back then. It was a case where you wanted to be a long-run show. I mean, you look at some of these shows now that play, if you look at their performance numbers, they look like failures because, you know, 90 performances, 120 performances, you know, that type of thing. But really, these, we're in an age where 14 weeks only exclamation point seems to be with in the ad campaigns of a lot of shows, and most of them don't extend beyond that. So you can only, as Goldman said, get these Hollywood people to exercise their theatrical muscles, and they do it, but they don't want to exercise for that long. I think we're going to see more and more of this. Bigger stars, shorter runs.
Another thing is, sadly, it's much harder to make a theater star nowadays. Exhibit A, Nina Arianda, I would say.
Sure.
That's someone who would have probably, you know,
been on the cover of Life magazine.
Yeah, and then also there would have been more good material available for her to, follow up with. But as it turned out, you know, she might have doing a revival of Born Yesterday, which...
Yeah, in the 50s, Kay Ballard was on the cover of Life magazine for being one component, not even a star, of the Golden Apple. She did have the hit song on the show, but that was really an ensemble show. And yet Kay Ballard's on the cover of Life magazine, and the nation took notice. Yeah, you know, that's what happened then. And yes, it's very hard to be a theater star now. Very hard indeed. So being known just simply for theater. And, you know, it's only a play, did not get wonderful reviews. And yet it certainly has done business, because it certainly stacked the deck with a lot of people that everybody knows. An Oscar winner is in the cast. Megan Mullally, very famous, you know, so on and so forth. So it is what we're going to see more of. You know, shorter runs, bigger stars.
And if I could answer James's question in another way, I would say that nowadays on Broadway, you have to have a star for everything, with the exception of if it happens to be a musical on subject matter that everyone wants to see. For example,
which does bring us to Sideshow, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well. but, you know, Beautiful is an example. And then also, if a musical opens and it wins Best Musical, even if it doesn't have anyone in it who would really be classified as a star, for example, Gentleman's Guide, that would be another exception. But then the jukebox, you know, Motown, things like that.
Kinky Boots, too, proves your point. Kinky Boots won the Tony and has done wonderful business. And there aren't stars as we know them in there. Nothing against either Billy Porter or Stark Sands. But, I mean, you know, I think they even admit that star is not a word that they would associate with them. And of course, Gentleman's Guide is the wonderful example. If you win that prize, suddenly you're selling out, because it certainly did not sell out until that prize was won.
But it's hard. It's really hard to think of a show that does that is not in either of one of those two categories that I just said. Either it's a musical that has some kind of broad appeal in terms of the music or the subject matter or whatever, or it's got a star in it. Whether it's a play or a musical, it's just because of the economics and people who are paying that much money, they want some kind of guarantee that at least I can say that I saw the sexiest man alive, almost naked on stage.
Indeed. My friend Karen Plesher certainly will go to see anything that Hugh Jackman is in. I mean, the poor soul has bought two tickets to the River. She's been once and she's about to go again just to be in the same room with that guy. That means a lot to her, and I mean, anybody who can sit through the River twice is really
Well, and interestingly enough, this is anecdotal, but I have heard that it is not impossible to get
you
tickets
bet
more.
So
there are limits. I mean, the arguably the biggest star on Broadway at the moment. With advanced sales that were reportedly through the roof, but there is, there are certain requirements in terms of the actual play.
Well, it's funny using the roof imagery. I mean, going through the roof and circling the square, there's still plenty of floors. In that office building. So maybe that's the case. It went through the roof, but then it suddenly stopped.
I could tell you that could become wicked. Just a quick discussion about Sideshow and its closing notice, and is there something rotten going on at the St. James?
Well, faithful listeners will know that I went to bat for Something Rotten a few weeks ago when I saw the workshop, so I'm delighted that it's coming in this season. It was raring to go. I mean, they could have opened the following day had the sets and costumes and the lighting all set, but really all I needed was a few days to tech is if they had the sets and costume, they could have opened. So while I feel bad for the people of Seattle, if indeed this is the case, that they're canceling their Seattle engagement, was supposed to start on Shakespeare's birthday, and I hope they're able to open on Shakespeare's birthday here at the St. James if that's the case. But frankly, I'm delighted. I want to see it sooner rather than later. So but still, that's still a way off. So why couldn't Sideshow stay around? I mean, we hear these things about stop clauses and they wanted them out. I also hear that the Jamsons were pretty good in saying, you don't, this is, by the way, hearsay. I always say what I hear may not be true at all. I can only tell you what I hear. But I understand that the Jamsons were really doing very well in giving them breaks on the rent. And they were really trying to make it work. So it's just too hard for Sideshow. That's all there is to it. But I do wonder if they had two famous ladies in those roles, if it would have been a different story based on what we were just talking about. The stars make the difference.
Also, based on what we were just talking about, Peter, do you assume that the actual show of Something Rotten will have the same stars, namely Christian Borle, Brian D'Arcy James?
I hope so. I mean, really, none of these people are people that the average person in Missouri knows, but nevertheless, Christian Borle, Gerald Cariani, Brian D'Arcy James, Beth Level, Kate Rangers, Brad
Oscar.
Who's magnificent in it. They all are. Alan Fitzpatrick, very good performance. I mean, really terrific theater people who we have seen time and time again give performances that we cherish. And we can only hope that they all stay with it. That would really be quite terrific. But I do know that they're auditioning this week for ensemble people. Mm-hmm. So, and the ensemble they had was extraordinarily strong. And I don't know if they want to replace them, the people have other jobs or what. But they are doing auditions this week. I think open calls. So if any of you want to be in Something Rotten, you know, I think they're doing open calls this week.
Well, the other aspect of it is that from an Actors Equity standpoint, they are required to do an open call.
Sure.
So
yeah,
even though there yeah. might not be any jobs available.
Sure, sure. That's fair. That's fair. Sure.
And it's so good for casting directors to have, you know, three or four backups or a swing or a standby or things like that for things that do come up, because such a talented cast, somebody will get offered a television show or a movie or something like that and have to put somebody in there. So it's just
you're right.
A little bit of good practice and a little bit of union requirements to have an open call.
Sure. I should have stressed that. You're quite right. And thanks for clarifying.
Well, and also Christian Borle is an interesting case because he's becoming increasingly known to people all over the country. The Sound of Music Live, which, you know, was seen by tremendous millions of people. Mm-hmm. And even Peter Pan Live was apparently about half the ratings. That's still a whole damn lot of people.
Even though the Smash ratings were truly terrible, the point is, yes, there's still a lot of people, comparatively speaking. So,
and Brian D'Arcy James as well, you know, has been venturing very deeply into television and film as well. So who knows, you know, if he gets called on to do a feature film or a television series, you know, they'll have to replace that. Not that I know anything about that, that he has something coming up, but that's certainly a possibility for any of those wildly talented folks
yes.
in the cast.
And yet we also have to concede the fact that I think it's possible that anybody who saw Smash and The Sound of Music and Peter Pan might not know Christian Borle's name. Mm-hmm. I think that's entirely possible.
Yeah, that's true.
But if you want to, you know, listen to Christian Borle, we had him on our January 12, 2014 podcast. And you can go back and listen to that, where he was very, very, very funny.
He's a lovely man.
He's such a great guy.
Oh, and just parenthetically, do either of you by any chance watch the TV show Nashville?
Uh-uh.
Benanti. I keep on saying Benanti, and she keeps on saying Benanti, James. Benanti. I'm like, hi, Laura, I don't know.
Benanti's so much prettier.
I know.
But Benanti's Jersey.
Jersey, yeah.
She's from Jersey.
Well, anyway, I don't watch it regularly, but I was flipping channels the other night, and she was on it, and Will Chase is a regular on.
Yeah.
So you might want to check that show out. It's really
natural.
Laura was great. She played, and then it just so coincidentally, a friend of mine, Jay Wilkerson, who did a few Broadway shows, including Rent, showed up as her ex-husband, and they had some really, really great scenes together. She's really wonderful on screen, and so is Jay. And then in the second scene, he punched her in the face and knocked her to the ground. So it was pretty dramatic on Nashville there for Laura Benanti.
Either way, I mean, considering that it is based on a Broadway musical, I am very surprised that the new Annie movie, which I have seen, has virtually no Broadway people in it. And I kept looking for them, and I was very, very surprised and disappointed that it didn't. It's not a terrible picture. It is not. They make a phenomenal mistake in it that I don't know how people could watch a picture. You know, obviously people work on it, watched it over and over and over again. I don't know how they could miss this certain point, and I will not give it away, but I will say that at 1 hour and 16 minutes, something happens in the Annie movie that completely negates the first scene you see in the picture and probably the third. A very famous thing happens in Annie that happens in the stage show, that has happened in every movie, the previous two ones too. But look at your watch while you're watching the movie, and at 1:16, tell me if you begin to believe for a tenth of a second what they're telling you, considering what you saw in the first scene, think about what you saw in the first scene, and one that you've seen a million times. So,
oh, well, Bobby Cannavale's in the movie.
Yes, he is. He gets to sing a little of Easy Street. What's really interesting is both Easy Street and Little Girls start off exactly the same way for the first four lines and then go into a completely different melody. I don't just mean lyric, I mean melody. So that's kind of strange, too. It starts off with most of the songs intact. I mean, Yes, Maybe's there. Yes, It's the Hard Knock Life is there. Yes, Tomorrow is there. And then you rarely again hear anything from the Broadway show. There are a few, but not many. You Never Fully Dressed Without a Smile, done very differently. I Don't Need Anything But You, done very differently. And here's the worst part of this picture. It's ashamed to be a musical.
Oh, sure.
Now, let me explain why. More than once, somebody will say something like, why are you singing?
Ugh.
But worst still, the Daddy Warbucks character in this movie, named Will Stax, is running for mayor. And at one point, he is seen on TV in a bar. These working stiff bar guys are hanging around the bar, and the TV is on, and there he is singing I Don't Need Anything But You with both Annie and Grace Farrell. And the line of dialogue, I may be a syllable off, but I'm not much more than that, is, hey, if this guy wants to be mayor, he's got to stop singing. Yeah, so.
Well, I have to say, everything you're saying, Peter, sounds like it does add up to a terrible movie.
No, because some of the plot twists and the reasons why things happen are very smart. The motivation now for it's Bobby Cannavale, who's the man behind the man. And he says to Will Stax, if you want to be mayor, it would be very smart of you to adopt a kid. That'll make you look good. So that's a good idea. I think that's very smart, you know, and so it's all politically motivated, and I think that hits the nail right on the head as far as that's concerned. You have a really corrupt guy behind the man, not unlike the movie Dave, which Noel Benjamin is making into a musical now, and I'm looking forward to that. If you saw the movie Dave, where Frank Langella plays the man behind the president, and it makes all the tough decisions, but also the illegal decisions. Well, Bobby Cannavale is the one who decides Annie's got to go, you know, and we've got to find her parents. And he does a lot of maneuvering to make that parent thing happen, and none of it is real, and he knows it. And I mean, he's really tremendously corrupt in the picture. So a lot of it makes a lot of sense. I mean, some of it really rings a bell, but and there are a few new songs. I mean, there's a different NYC song while they're flying over New York in a helicopter. The cinematography is extraordinary. Nobody's going to say about this one, oh, it's just a film stage play. Not at all. That camera does a lot of interesting things in this picture. So I think we can all relax in that it is not an atrocity. And for those of us who feared that the music would be far too rock oriented, it's not bad. The orchestrations are not what I feared they would be. It's very listable. So there were a lot of things in the movie that really got my respect. But
well, that's interesting what you said about the political thing, because I guess, I mean, that is sort of in the original, except that he's not officially a politician.
He's not a politician. It's out of the goodness of his heart that every Christmas he takes an orphan in. That's the way it's established. Here, it's far differently motivated.
Oh, but I just meant that I think, you know, Grace even says something in the original, like something about your image. And you know, we see him hobnobbing with the president and stuff. So I guess it's the germ of the same idea, but they're just bringing it home that it's for, you know, that the main motivation is pure politics.
I will tell you, this is a movie that's going to date very fast, though, because I mean, there are so many references. No, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say there was a reference once to Facebook, once to Google, once to Twitter, once to City Bikes. I mean, you know, it's going to really seem very 2014 in the years to come. So it's going to seem quaint, you know, the people are referring to these things, because God knows what innovations we're going to have in the next few years that's going to make Facebook, Google, and Twitter look antiquated. You know, we all know enough about technology, those of us who
bought a track. All we have to say is one thing. We just have to say Friendster.
Yes, you know, right.
Friendster was the rage, you know, 10 years ago.
Sure.
I found one more little jewel in the cast of Annie the movie, the 2014 movie, is Patricia Clarkson from The Elephant Man.
Wow.
Is in the movie of Annie. So let's all move forward here. Peter got a chance to see In the Fields Where They Lay at the New Ohio Theater. Peter, tell us.
Well, this is a very easy play and place to not be on anybody's radar. If you know where the Lucille Lortel Theater is, it's a couple of blocks going towards the river. It's on the other side of the street. It's very painful for me to go there because there are so many gyms in the neighborhood reminding me of how out of shape I am. But anyway, I still go there when asked to go. And this turned out to be a riveting experience. In Fields Where They Lay, a play by Ricardo Perez Gonzalez, is so tense. I mean, I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to take it because the story deals with World War One. It takes place literally 100 years ago because it dealt with the fact that during World War One, this new idea came up that has since been used again. Why don't we have a truce on Christmas Day? The Germans fighting the British, you know, just for Christmas. Can we stop things just for now? And it deals with that day. And you get to know the guys in the army. There's a black man who comes from Jamaica who is pretty much scorned because he's a black man, even though he's one of the smartest in the group. There are children. There are two 16-year-olds who have enlisted. You know, they lied about their age to get in, and they're so naive in so many ways. You have the hard-ass type of soldier. It's very well orchestrated in terms of character as far as that's concerned. But the tension is so amazing, and certainly that you keep on expecting the truce to be broken. I mean, there's a scene where they're singing Christmas carols, both the Germans and the English. The First Noel, I mean, obviously, if the show's called In Fields Where They Lay, Silent Night. And you keep on waiting for that shot to burst out, and you don't want it to happen. There is a tremendous line where somebody says we should keep going, and one of the commanders says, "Oh, sure." You know, so what's the next big holiday after New Year's? What should we do? And somebody says, well, I guess it's Ash Wednesday, which is kind of interesting because in those days, you know, to think that Ash Wednesday was considered a big day, you know, I mean, I don't think that's really as true anymore. So anyway, and the commander says, sure, great. Let's give up war for Lent, you know, and it's a funny line. But of course, why not? You know, why not give up war totally? And that's, of course, what the play is about. If you can stop for one day, why can't you stop, period? Why must it be? The Germans come over to where the British are, and they exchange cigarettes, and they show pictures of their family. But you keep on waiting for one trigger happy person to break the truce. And it does happen. And what's so good, once that truce is broken, and I don't think it's really a spoiler to say that, because I would think that anybody would expect that it would have to happen, because we know, historically speaking, the war did not end on December 25th, 1914. So I don't think I'm giving too much away. But there's a scene that takes place after the truce is broken that is so heartbreaking, so moving, so poignant, that I think it's really worth getting down to this very obscure theater that a lot of people don't know about. This is really off Broadway, no question about it. It's one of these places where you got to ring the doorbell to get in. You got to go down a flight of stairs. It's not a bad space, but I mean, you don't feel like you're on a night in the town, believe me. But still, when the occasion warrants, this is the type of thing that should be seen. And I hope there's a future for this play. Extraordinarily well acted, and I mean, a rather difficult physical production too, that demands a lot of attention from a lot of people in terms of moving of sets, that type of thing, that that is worthwhile seeing too. It's a nice job of moving the pieces of a unit set around so it doesn't look like a unit set anymore. So I highly recommend With Fields of the Day. I really was dreading hearing that gunshot, that first gunshot. And the fact that I never knew when it was coming really had my proverbial heart in my mouth.
Well, I have not seen it yet, but I will say what a wonderful title for the double meaning in the first Noel. The first Noel the angels did say was to certain poor shepherds in fields where they lay, just meaning where they rested, resting in the fields. Right. Yeah. But obviously, it can be taken as a double meaning of soldiers lying dead on a battlefield.
Yes, and Bill mentioned about the fact that, you know, do we dare bury our dead now? Because if we do it now, our backs will be to them, and therefore, you know, it'll be easy to be shot. The folly of war really does come up in this, and and it's very smart that it's an intermissionless play, too. It's about 100 minutes. And the fact that it's intermissionless, you know, really underlines the point that war is continuous. There are no intermissions in war, even though this play is about an intermission in war, that even though the truce has been called, will it be honored? You know, so that's pretty arresting. I'm so glad I went. Mm.
Well, that's an excellent recommendation. Peter, I was looking around. Would you know how long it's running for?
Till the 27th. December 27th.
Oh, December 27th. Okay.
So it is a case where they're really conforming to the Christmas holidays because that's when the play takes place. So.
All righty. So let's move forward to the last review of the day. The Soul Doctor has revisited us after their Broadway run, and they're back at the Actors Temple, and Peter got a chance to get up and see it. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's still no good, I'm sorry to say. They've eliminated the intermission, so people who would want to walk out, like my girlfriend, would have a harder time of it. But
we talked about eliminating the intermission last week, so they followed through on your advice.
Yeah, you know, I got to say that I have no patience for this story at all, because it's sort of a minor league version of The Jazz Singer, which is a very famous property from almost 100 years ago, dealing with the fact, let's deal with The Jazz Singer first, which, to be quick about it, is simply about a boy whose father expects him to be a rabbi, and he becomes a jazz singer. And of course, the father is appalled by this. Same thing happens here. The father is a very religious man, a very Orthodox Jew, and the fact that his kid wants to be a folk singer disturbs him immeasurably. It's worse here because the boy is not giving up the idea of religion. He wants to have religion spread, the Jewish religion spread, by folk music rather than by liturgical music. So, I mean, while the kid, the jazz singer, essentially is interested in being totally away from the religion. I don't mean that he turns anti-religion, but I mean his occupation has nothing to do with religion. The boy in this show is still interested in spreading the word of Judaism. Mm. So the fact that the father is so intractable, and it drives you crazy. I mean, lighten up, guy, will you please? He's not turning his back on Judaism at all. He's just seeing it in a different way. I also think the dialogue is truly, truly excruciating. There are a lot of epigrammatical type things that people just would not say, but it strikes as interesting writing. So to the guy who wrote it, but I'm amazed it came back, and I don't know if it's going to find any more success at the Actors Temple on 47th Street. I will admit, it was a full house that I went. I don't know how many people paid. Maybe everybody did. I hope everybody did. Very big cast, 14 people in it for an off-Broadway show. That's a lot these days, for even for a musical. And the cast certainly does its job, no question about that. Oh, what a terribly frustrating thing to sit through. And I can't imagine it's going to be with us very much longer.
All right. So one wonders why.
One does wonder why.
Yeah. Why it, obviously it closed, I think, short of its goal on Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't remember the details, but I do remember reading there is a particular person apparently who is 100% behind this.
Yeah, that's all you
piece,
need.
And who has lots and lots of money, and he really believes in it. And so I mean, obviously, they probably would have been better off.
Starting off Broadway.
Yes.
Yes. Michael, when that happens, don't they typically go to the Little Schubert?
Well,
they
they
do.
I guess, yeah. I mean, I don't know if it really qualifies as a vanity production in the normal sense, because the person who is behind it is not
starring in it,
yeah. or didn't write it. But yes, I it's one of those situations.
All right, so. I guess that's kind of it for right now. Do you guys want to mention anything that's coming up for you this week?
I don't even know what is on my schedule this week. It's a lot of time for parties, I'll tell you that. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So I'm seeing the Into the Woods movie this week. And I'm also going to be going to Philadelphia to see Wayne Bryan's production of Mary Poppins. He's such a talented director. The miracles he's achieved in Wichita have been extraordinary, and I certainly want to see what he does with Mary Poppins, so it's worth a 90-mile ride back and forth to see. So that'll be on Thursday, and I'm looking forward to that matinee. And by the way, it's doing business. I mean, I'm going to be sitting in the Bezidee with one seat, you know, that type of thing. So it was really great that to hear that they're really doing business. I guess we shouldn't be so surprised. But the Walnut Street Theater, which I believe is the oldest theater in the country, though it certainly has been refurbished and doesn't look like the oldest theater in the country. But it's nice how that has managed to become a real regional theater that puts on its own productions. Because the other theaters in Philadelphia, the Forest, the Schubert, which is now the Merriam, get bookings every now and then, and that's about it. And the Locust is long gone, let alone the Erlanger. But to see that the Walnut solved its problems by becoming a real resident theater, you know, doing productions is very good.
Now,
I'm sorry.
The Prince Center in Philadelphia, aren't they stopping productions of Legit?
Oh yeah, long gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
And did I read what I was going to say was, did I just read that there is an attempt to save the Philadelphia Theater Company?
Yeah. Yes.
Going on. Yeah.
Yeah. They've had terrible problems, which is sad because it's a very nice company. I've every experience I've had there has been terrific. So I'm very sorry that they've gone through it. But this is one of those cases, too. You know, you move to a new space, a new, handsome, wonderful space. You know, it's sometimes it saves you and sometimes it doesn't. You know, and this is an example of where too bad that it seems that they bit off more than they can chew, but let's hope that that nourishment comes really fast to save it.
I'm seeing to tomorrow night, the 15th, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, which I mentioned, and we were fortunate to have Doug Sills on our podcast last week. He was really great. But because I'm seeing that, I cannot see at roughly the same time a reading of Gerard Alessandrini and Peter Brash have written a musical based on The Nutcracker, which was done last year or 2 years ago at the George Street Theater in Jersey. Did you see it, Peter?
Oh, yes. Right. You know, it's funny. I was thinking this sounds familiar. Yeah. So well, that's great. I'm glad that that's still on the horizon. But, you know, of course, Michael, what we're learning, and we learned a long time ago, you can't see them all.
No, you can't see them all.
Too many, you know.
But
so.
they've reworked it, and I'm happy to say they went back to a title that I think they had the idea originally, and they were afraid to use it. But the title is now The Nutcracker and I.
Ah.
That's right.
So I'm sorry I'm going to miss this reading, but I hope and trust that we will see it in the future and in many places.
Hey, that Brigadoon is getting a reading this weekend. The Brigadoon, I believe that it was in Chicago. But anyway, there is definitely a reading, an industry reading of Brigadoon this Friday. Thursday, too, is I believe. We may yet see Brigadoon revived on Broadway because obviously they're not doing this because they just want to give Alan J. Lerner and Fritz Lowe a nice Christmas present. I mean, so I think we may very well see a Brigadoon in our future.
Did either one of you guys go to see The Illusionists?
No.
So I went to go see it. I took my wife.
Yeah.
I went to go see it. I took my wife, and the press reps asked us if we'd like to bring our children. So we brought our kids too. And and we saw The Illusionists. And while I don't think that a show like this needs to be in a Broadway theater, it's very entertaining production, and some of the things are just really wow, and it's very funny, you know, on a Bugs Bunny type of level where you have both adult and children humor happening at the same exact time, and it's really enjoyed it. I'm not sure, you know, it needs to be in a Broadway theater, but it was nice to go to the Marquee.
Speaking of the Marquee and the Broadway theater, since there's been so much construction around there for so long, may I ask if anything was done in the theater itself? Or is it...
I can't really tell.
Okay.
Probably not
is the answer, but nevertheless, yeah. I just thought because there was so much construction going on, maybe some sort of cosmetic thing went on there. I'm not saying it even needed it. I'm just saying I just wonder if they did something in there since so much was going around.
Yeah, it's a big, vast cavern still. So
uh-huh. But not as big as that big sign that's on Broadway now, that electronic sign, right? Yeah.
Well, there's bigger electronic signs inside during the show of The Illusionists. So, you know, it seems to be traveling around the United States. If you like magic, I would go see it. It's an entertaining thing.
They do business, too.
Yeah. Mm. Although I'd rather see book shows in a Broadway theater. There's, I guess, The Illusionists, it fit into their schedule to do it on Broadway, and they were excited about it. So,
all right. But now the implication is that theater's available for rental, right? I mean, somebody can go in there, right? I mean, there's nothing else that.
I can't imagine why not.
Construction's all done, right? Pretty looking box office, too, on 46th Street now.
Yeah, you can't get from the box office to the theater, so you have to still go through the lobby of the hotel to get in. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's in the future plans or what's going to happen there, but certainly with so much traffic of shows waiting to get a theater, I don't know why nobody's jumping in there unless there's other things that are still planned to go on there.
The thing about the box office, it's on street level and it's all glass. So, I mean, I wonder if that's going to help with impulse ticket buying, you know, oh, there's the box office. You know, I mean, I just wonder if that's going to be a factor at all. I don't know how much impulse ticket buying there is with ticket prices being so high. I think more impulse ticket buyers go to the
TKTS.
Yeah, the push cart, you know, but all things considered, I think it's a good experiment to have glass on a street floor level so that you can see that people do buy tickets. Of course, I guess if your show is not doing well, to see nobody at the box office might be a deterrent too. So I guess it is a double-edged sword.
Well, Mr. Riedel's column this week with Tony Danza, hawking shows for tickets for Honeymoon in Vegas at the TKTS booth and doing stuff like that.
God love him.
You know,
I mean, the first time I met Gary Beach was when he was doing the same thing for Something's Afoot back in the 70s. you know, but Tony Danza does have a much bigger profile than Gary Beach did then. So it's really great that he's doing that. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, he's a producer and he has something at stake beyond the fact of his own role in the show. But still, how many people with shows in trouble would begin to deign to do anything like that? So, you know, credit where it's due.
Two news items, which I had missed this, but I guess it was announced 4 days ago. The aforementioned Laura Benanti.
Yeah, there you go.
Benanti. Will be starring in Radio City's New York Spring Spectacular.
Great.
That's kind of amazing. And the other thing, this is not totally theater related, but the Lowe's Kings Theater in Flatbush, which is apparently an amazing old movie palace, has been restored at a cost of something like $93 million. And it's now going to be a concert venue, and it's going to open with Diana Ross in February. So I'm sure that after that, they're going to be it's a big place, 3,000 mm-hmm. seats. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're going to get lots of people who are going to be on our radar, and we're definitely going to want to see. And it's great to have another venue like that, especially a restored, beautiful old one.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great. We have to keep our eyes on that to see if maybe our obligatory reference to Jennifer Ashley Tepper, maybe she will open up 54 Below 2 in Flatbush or something like that, because certainly they are growing by leaps and bounds, 54 Below, and it's hard to get a booking in there. People are saying, well, I thought I could get in. People want to do their shows, and they just can't get in there to do it because they're so solidly booked. So no, that's a wonderful success story.
A very bad thing for New York if that place failed. It really would, because it's such a beautiful little room. It really is. It's a great place to be in. You feel like you're in New York City. And so I'm glad that she's doing a good job, and I'm not surprised that she is.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us on Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and have us stream directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Peter, for Michael, or for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have maybe a trivia question for us that you could throw out to the audience?
Yeah, why not? We've talked about this in the past, that we thought it would be a good idea to offer trivia to our listeners. And I do on my Critchland column a brain teaser every month, just one a month. At the end of the month, or the beginning of the new month, I tend to do that. So I'm going to offer this month's brain teaser, and let's see how smart we are out there. What do these musicals have in common? Okay. Annie, Big, Hair, Baby, Once, Dream, Rocky, Saturday Night, and Follies. Once more, Annie, Big, Hair, Baby, Once, Dream, Rocky, Saturday Night, and Follies. So anyway, let's see if you can figure that out. And what happens if you win, James?
Well, if you win, we'll give you the Mary Testa CD.
Okay.
So folks who email us all the contact information at Broadway Radio, we will pick a random winner out of the many, many people who will get the correct answer, because not only are all of our listeners beautiful, but they're also smart. So if you have the correct answer, email it to us, and out of the vast number of people that will have gotten it correct, we will pick a winner. And we'll send you Mary Testa's CD. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, terror. Thank you, disillusionment. Thank you, frailty. Thank you, consequence. Thank you. Thank you, silence. The moment was the moment I got more than I could handle. The moment I jumped off of it was the moment I touched down. How about no longer being masochistic? How about remembering your divinity? How about unabashedly bawling your eyes out? How about not equating death with stopping?